episode 1A of the Software Freedom Law Show. Hi, and welcome to episode 1A of the Software Freedom Law Show. We've gotten to a serious landmark in HEX.
I don't think it has to be some sort of double letter.
Well, it's AA or something. It's more of a landmark for our audience, that those members of our audience who may not be as familiar with HEX.
Yeah, but we already went through A through F zero.
I guess so, but we were in double digit numerics for so long.
It's going to be double digit forever. I only
No. But
FF will be our last show if we make it.
Integers. We were in integers before. We were in base 10 integers.
No, we've never been in base 10. What?
No, we were never in base 10, but those were the numbers we were using.
Except for OC.
I know. We were using 0 to 9. Now we have gotten to the point of counting in hex where we're using letters.
We've already been through one.
We were out of it for such a long period.
And we're back to letters.
You were the one who didn't like saying we're back.
But we're back to letters. We are back to something.
Anyway,
we should say who we are, because I realize other podcasts do that and we've never done that. I'm Bradley Kuhn of the Software Freedom Law Center.
And I'm Karen Sandler, also of the Software Freedom Law Center.
And this is the Software Freedom Law Show.
I feel like we need the music again.
Well, we should do that in the future. We're going to do that right as we come out.
We will. Music. Okay.
Now we're just learning how to do this new thing that we're going to do.
And if you think we can do something better, let us know. What do you mean, even the outlaws?
Well, they're outlaws, right?
I would say the outlaws do it.
But they're outlaws, right? So they would buck the common methodology for podcasting since they're outlaws.
And we're talking about...
And they don't even buck it.
The Linux Outlaws podcast, which if you aren't already a fan of, you should check it out.
Yeah, because our producer of this show is one of the hosts of that, so we sort of have to mention...
And even if we didn't have to, we would want to.
Well, sometimes we should. We're recording in my... I'm going to say week again, which we should never do. This episode, we're recording in my office, which I apologize to Karen, is a mess of computers everywhere.
It's really not so bad.
Well, you should have seen it yesterday. Or the day before. I had like three computers.
Actually, I did see it yesterday.
Oh, no, it was the day before. I think I cleaned it up the day before. Anyway, I had computers apart in here and stuff because it's a nonprofit, so there's lots of work to be done, some of which you don't always want to have to do, but I'm the only one with sysadmin-y skills around here, so I end up doing the sysadmin work, and we had a RAID array in degraded mode, and I saved it before it died. Actually, I'm still on that server running, so it wasn't as urgent as I thought, but eventually that server's going to die, but there's nothing on it of importance now, thanks to lots of work copying things all over the place.
And you have stacks of computers in your office, which I guess when we were recording in my office, we had stacks of paper.
That's true. Well, we had the stacks of, because I was trying to find, we had all these, because I always buy used computers, because it's better for the environment to buy used computers, I think. And so I bought all these computers. I was trying to find the right one to use, and so I went through all of them.
Right.
Trying to find the right one, which is why they're all still here. So I apologize for the mess.
Well, thank you for doing it.
For making the mess?
taking care of the tasks that need to be done that have created the mess that is now represented.
Well, it reminds me of something Larry Wall once said in one of his State of the Onion speeches. He said that always try to do what you want to do now, because any job you ever do, you'll always be doing. And he says, for example, I started my career as a projectionist, and then he looks at the fact that he's projecting slides up as he's giving his talk and points out that he's still a projectionist.
That's funny.
In a way. So I started my career as a sysadmin, and I guess I'll always sometimes be a sysadmin. But I have a lot of respect for the profession of system administration. So
I was going to say, I started, I guess my first job was in fast food, and I'm still in the service industry.
That's true. I did have a job as a dishwasher before I was a sysadmin. That's true enough.
Yeah.
So I do, and I wash the dish. I actually run the dishwasher every morning here. See?
That's true.
So I still am a dishwasher, too.
Well, anyway, getting back to our show.
This is our show.
This is our show, but we've got a really exciting guest, and I want to get to the interview without too much further ado.
Yeah, we're pushing our way through every nonprofit person in the free software and related spaces with...
I just think it's so great. Like, you know, there are so many people working and doing good things at nonprofits related to our field and peripherally related to our field, that it's super exciting that we get to talk to them regularly.
Yeah, and have them on as guests, and they usually agree. And that's
good. We've been very lucky. Yeah. And we're lucky this time, and we'll be back soon. Back, you know, you like when I say back.
That's true. In this instance, yes.
With our interview.
Oh, and it's we're doing some sort of surprise thing. I forgot. Sorry.
Are we?
I'm not going to say. Well, we haven't said it yet. And remember that one person wrote in to say that they liked when we do the surprise thing and you like the surprise thing. So I'm sold on the surprise thing. So we're not going to say who it is. But after the music, you'll hear who it is. So we are lucky today to have as our guest, we haven't had a guest in a while, Mike Linksfair from the Creative Commons. Welcome to the show, Mike.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. You know, I don't know. It's been a while, but we usually kick off our interviews with asking our interviewees about their background. So, and I think our audience will be very excited to hear about your background because you work at Creative Commons. So why don't you tell us a little bit about, you know, how you got involved with Creative Commons and got involved there.
Sure. I guess the short story is that I had a startup that happened to employ the first Creative Commons designer, and they were looking for a tech lead, and the designer recommended me because he knew I would be interested, and my involvement proceeded from there. I'm now the longest serving employee, and I've sort of morphed from being the webmaster at the very beginning, although my title was fancier than that, to the person who manages most of the organization, except for our science and education programs. The slightly longer story as to why he knew I'd be very interested is I've been very interested in intellectual property issues, to use the word that we shouldn't use. starting when I was in college, I studied economics and somehow got interested in things like TRIPS and thought that they were an affront to trade. And I was also, because of some experience in high school using a BBS that ran on Unix, really wanted to run Unix on my computer. And so kind of the interest in the economics of intangible goods and wanting more freedom there and wanting to run Unix on my own computer led me to follow things like the GNU project, and then Linux kernel project started when I was a junior, I guess. So I followed that intensely, and that's kind of how I got involved in software freedom and have been primarily a big fan since. I haven't contributed a whole lot more than random patches and bug reports.
You know, Mike, this is really funny for me because we've known each other for, I guess, a year and a half or so, and we never actually talked about this, but your background and mine are so similar. I say a lot of the same things about how I got involved because I wanted a Unix-based system on my own computer, and my rise through the Free Software Foundation was very similar to yours at Creative Commons. I started as RMS's assistant and then eventually was mostly running the place. And also, the last thing you said, which is what my biggest embarrassment is, I'm primarily only given a few patches here and there rather than actually contributing major amounts of code. So we have even more in common than I realized. So one of the things that is really cool about Creative Commons is that it really covered, I think, a space that we weren't handling as well in the free software world, which was freedom respecting licenses for works other than software. Basically, FSF created a couple of licenses, and Apache and other communities created interesting licensing as well for software. But you guys really took on the task of how to handle the freedom of licensing and licensings that respect people's rights and freedoms in other spaces. On the other hand, it's a really complicated area, right?
Oh, I was just going to interject because I think that, I think a lot of our listeners know about the Creative Commons licenses, but I think they might not know generally what the organization is, you know, what the organization's goals are and, you know, what sort of, I guess it's direction as you talked about the different programs. So, I personally was curious to know, you know, how many lawyers there were at Creative Commons. I guess I just maybe to state what, you know, what Creative Commons is generally, so our listeners know.
Sure. I we should step all the way back and just say that Creative Commons is a nonprofit, and we're based in San Francisco. And I would describe the overall mission as making people's desire to share more effective. So the primary product, if you will, that we offer is a suite of copyright licenses that are they're public copyright licenses, so much like inspired by and in terms of the mechanisms, very similar to the public copyright licenses used in the software world, but they're intended for non-software works. And they offer a range of options that result in six core licenses. The most permissive one requires sharing with or does not require sharing with attribution. Allows sharing with attribution, so you can remix for commercial purposes as long as you give credit. They're the one that free software people like the best is called Attribution Share Alike, which is a copyleft license. So, and then there are more restrictive ones that fall out of the scope of what's generally thought of as free as in freedom. And then we have also some public domain tools, which aren't licenses. And then the parts of our organization that I don't manage have some other tools that are don't fall within the copyright scope. For instance, our science program has also started looking at material transfer agreements. So actually, to make it easier to transfer actual biological materials between labs, because the lack of standardized regimes is hindering that form of sharing.
Yeah, I'm definitely interested in that science stuff, but that's probably a topic for another show, because what I think I really wanted to talk to you about was that whole suite of licenses, and that's what I was getting at before. The gold standard, I think, in a lot of the free software community when they look at a license for things like documents and other types of written works is CC BY-SA. And the thing I want to draw attention to there first is you guys are actually have created these little monikers that are really interesting. And can you talk a little bit about how they work and how the little logos work on the sites and so forth?
Yeah, sure. So as I was saying, there's a set of six core licenses, and those are a result of kind of non-mutually exclusive combinations of a few properties, those being attribution, which are part of all of them. Non-commercial is one option. So if you allow commercial use, then that option is just left off. And then with regard to derivative works, you can either not put any constraints on them, or you can require what we call share alike, which is essentially copyleft. Or you can prohibit derivative works, which we call no derivs or no derivatives. And there are icons for each of those attributes, as well as short abbreviation. So Attribution Share Alike is often called CC BY-SA, and there's a button that has a little person signifying attribution and a copyleft button, basically, that says share alike. And there are other, if you choose a non-commercial license, then there's a $/ that goes on that button. Each license is meant to be understandable to the public in terms of its high level terms, what the licensor intended at a glance.
I think those little logos are so valuable, because I think that especially, you know, the audience of people who are interested in using those licenses, it makes them a lot more accessible. Mm-hmm. You know, at the same time, you know, maybe as a lawyer, I sort of wonder if maybe sometimes they're, I guess maybe I'm wondering if you have any experiences of people maybe oversimplifying what the licenses actually say based on the icons, which again, I think are incredibly powerful and helpful.
I don't know if people necessarily oversimplify based on the presence of the icons. I mean, that is a complaint we get occasionally, like, why don't you just make people read the license? But I think the reality is that for most people, more information isn't going to lead to better understanding of what the terms are.
That's funny. That is actually what we were sort of talking about.
Yeah, I am. I mean, we've actually sort of seen the same challenge in the software world. There's actually, it's weird because, of course, GPL and the free software licenses have been around longer than the CC licenses historically, but we've reached a point which probably CC is headed towards as well in its probably near future, where most of the community understands the basics of the license, but they get some of the details really wrong. And some of these beliefs about the details get propagated through the community as lore, effectively. And you have this weirdness where, well, that's not really what the license says. It's just the lore that people believe is true. And I think that that's an open problem of how we combat that. I think we're at this place where we want a simple moniker. In the free software case, we have GPL, Apache, very simple monikers to describe certain types of licenses. And the same thing with the CC licenses. There are these monikers, but yet we still have people confused about what the details mean. So I think that's just a challenge we all face. And I think it's just an education effort.
It's probably inherent to legal documents for regular people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, Mike, sorry, do you have something you wanted to add there?
No, I agree with you. I mean, it's just an ongoing challenge to educate. And when people happen to be using a license incorrectly or making an incorrect statement about it, then they should need to be corrected. But there's no magic bullet, obviously.
Yeah. I've actually had an interesting experience lately with CC licenses, choosing between them. I have traditionally done my talks. I actually learned this from Stallman way back when, of not allowing modifications to my talks and to my slides. Basically out of a worry that someone might misrepresent what I've said or mix it up in some way that makes it not clear. And since they're statements of opinion about what I think and feel, it seemed like a no derives CC license was the right choice. Yet I've got a lot of pushback in the community. I gave a talk recently at the Ontario Linux Fest, and there were people both on Identica and personally coming up to me saying, why is your license no derives? And can you make it CC by SA? By the end of the conference, I was walking around telling people when they walked up to me, by the way, my talk CC by SA, I give you permission, CC by SA. That's what it is. And you and I, Mike, have had a debate, for basically since we've known each other about when it's appropriate to use no derives. And this whole question, I was curious if you could tell our listeners sort of your views on that.
Well, I would say it's from the free software perspective, it's never, or free as in freedom perspective anyway, I would say it's never appropriate to use no derives. And with regard to the concern about misrepresentation, actually, all of the CC licenses, so that would include CC BY, or all of the ones that allow adaptations cover that. So if you want to potentially censor somebody, or use copyright to censor somebody for misrepresenting you, which is a question of whether you want to have that choice at all, but assume that you want that choice, the tools are built into the licenses that allow derivative works. So if you look at CC BY SA, for example, in sections 4A and 4B, I'll just read really briefly. One tool is, if you create an adaptation upon notice from any licensor, you must, to the extent practical, remove from the adaptation any credit as required by section 4B as requested. So you can demand that attribution to you be removed if you think that your views are being misrepresented in an adaptation. Then, in the case of an adaptation, a credit identifying the use of the work in the adaptation, for example, French translation of the work by original author, or screenplay based on the original work by original author. So, if you make an adaptation, then you actually have to say that it is an adaptation and not represented as just being the verbatim work of the original author. And then finally, you may not implicitly or explicitly assert or imply any connection with sponsorship or endorsement by the original author or licensor and or attribution parties. So I think that the desire to to use the license as a tool to prohibit misrepresentation, the Free As in Freedom licenses give you all of the tools that you need. But as a general policy matter, I think it is just a bad idea to prohibit derivative works, especially for matters of opinion or political works, because of the overarching diminution of fair use. And those are exactly the kinds of works where maximum latitude should be allowed for criticism. And I think it's important to make a statement that you allow remixing of those works, so that even if fair use didn't apply, that you would not use copyright to censor those opinions.
Now, Bradley's looking at me because, as I think we've mentioned at other times on the show, I've been the holdout in switching to essay on certain presentations and on the show. And, you know,
on this podcast itself, currently and, still no derivatives.
You know, and what makes me hesitate is connected to a lot of the things that you talked about. And part of, I think, what makes me doubly concerned is that as a lawyer, there are sort of extra considerations, which then maybe I just feel like I'm stepping out there to defend my position, but, you know, when you're a lawyer, you're worried about your, what you say as being interpreted as legal advice. Now, to be very lawyerly, the show is not legal advice, but in the instance where we do talk about legal matters and I'm sort of giving my opinion or view on a matter, you know, taken out of context means that someone might actually think that they're getting legal advice on something in a particular way and they're not. And in the licenses would put an affirmative duty upon me to monitor their usage to make sure that there's no misinterpretation of my legal advice out there. And that's what sort of makes me nervous. Now, that's a very specific concern. And it's, you know, I agree with you that generally derivative works, I mean, more than generally, that almost always derivative works should be permitted.
Yeah. And actually, I'm Mike's sort of walkthrough there of the various different mechanisms in CC by SA had pretty much convinced me. I was already heading right towards it, especially after the experience of this show where I got serious pushback from community. It's the first time I've ever gotten pushback for not having a free enough license by a community. So yeah. It really took me aback because I'm like, whoa,
on your presentation.
I must be wrong because the community's always happy with my licensing, but now they aren't. So I'm actually pretty convinced I'm going to switch my website in the coming weeks over to CC by SA, and I'm going to start making my talks that way by default rather than having to run around giving extra licenses on the back end.
Except where we present together.
Oh, that's true. So you have not been convinced. That's true. But
we'll
keep working
on it.
Well,
you know, it's convincing. It's just
Mike's been giving me a hard time about this for like a year, and I'm finally coming around.
It's just I think maybe you know my reputation of as somewhat of a nervous Nelly lawyer is well deserved, and that I just want to make sure that nobody's confused by what advice that I give, and that you know I'm not.
But this is not legal advice.
This is not legal advice.
No legal advice.
No legal advice
here.
Okay.
So we should probably move on.
Well, I'm not a lawyer of any sort, but I guess offline I would like to understand your concerns more about misrepresentation and having offered the license requiring you to monitor use. It sounds like a very hypothetical.
Yeah, actually, that's what I was thinking about myself. At least I can only speak for myself. But my what I basically have decided almost in the past few minutes, although I was sort of thinking about this before, is that I should start licensing my stuff, CC by SA, my blog and my website and my talks, and actually see if something goes wrong, and actually see if I actually run into the situation where somebody has misrepresented me, and see if it turns out to actually be a violation of CC by SA. In some sense, you've got to experiment with that as a community to see, does CC by SA as a license take care of these things and do these provisions work? We did the same thing with GPL. In fact, we wrote the GPL and did enforcement and saw if V2 really worked for what it was needed to do for defending copyleft. And there are actually improvements on those provisions in V3 for that reason.
Yeah, I think the reality is that 99.9% of misrepresentation wouldn't involve copyright. I mean, just doesn't involve copyright at all. People all the time do a short quote which isn't even the real quote. They just, you know, reporters.
The Daily Show effect.
Get stuff wrong. Yeah. And your views are misrepresented. So.
Yeah, but I would be happy to talk to you more about my concerns and the concerns that we, you know, I've discussed with other lawyers about our publication of our thoughts anyway. Because these are things. When I talked about the affirmative duty, I meant more that, well, I have to notify someone to remove attribution, and that becomes the affirmative duty. Well, but we can move on to that.
I think we should move on. I do want to relate this also to software. I know that generally speaking, the goal of Creative Commons is not really to touch the area of software licenses, but one place I want to talk about the intersection is with regard to the free documentation license that you and I were talking, Mike, on Identica, about the thing I raised in a previous podcast, which was, in some ways, the FDL is not necessarily the best license all the time for works of technical usefulness, like software documentation, like Wikipedia, for example, and the recent changes to FDL were, in fact, to allow Wikipedia to go CC by SA. So I'm curious if what your view is. My feeling has been that the right thing to do, given the FDL still around, and given that some people like the FDL, some people like CC by SA, I sort of prefer a disjunctive dual license, FDL or CC by SA, or both at your choice. Do you have an opinion on that? Do you feel what the right approach is for those types of works of technical usefulness?
I have no objection to disjunctive dual licensing. If part of the community likes the FDL, I think that the nature of copyleft is that it works best when there's kind of one magnet, and it turns out that CC by SA is it, in particular after the Wikipedia migration. In fact, the Fedora project just in the last couple of days migrated all of their wiki and various documentation to CC by SA from an even older license, the Open Publication License, but it kind of creates a but I mean that's just another big decision by a software distributor to choose CC by SA. So I think for reasons of interoperability and encouraging more people to use a copyleft license for their documentation, CC by SA should probably be the default choice. But again, I think it's totally fine to do a license with FDL, and in some cases also with the GPL, perhaps if there's code in the documentation.
So one last thing I want to ask about the CC licenses is how trademark issues interact. We get this question a lot in the software world too. So I'm curious in the CC world how the trademark issues of trademarks on names or names of projects and that sort of thing interact with the various CC licenses, if at all.
I would say not at all, in the sense that a license or offering work under a Creative Commons license isn't offering any trademark license. So if you would need additional permission to use trademarks that are included in the work, then you need additional permission.
I think there's some information on the Creative Commons website about that.
Okay. Yeah, and we'll link to that in the show notes for sure. So to switch topics for something completely different, MoneyPython speak, we should talk a little bit, Mike, about how you and I have been on this autonomous committee and been looking at the issue of network services. And I've talked some about it on the show. One of the podcasts was actually my talk about this issue that I give. But I wanted to give you an opportunity to talk some of your views about it, and then maybe we can go back and forth a little bit about what we've been doing in autonomous the last year and a half or so.
Sure. Well, I think it's interesting because I view it as kind of the cutting edge of where software and the stuff that Creative Commons does come together, or both are highly relevant. In order for a user at this point to control their computing environment, they're often interacting with software that's on the web, but they're also publishing works of authorship, as Stallman would call them, or collaborating on those works of authorship with others. And if those works aren't under a public license, then the user is publishing works and contributing to works, but they have no control over them. So I find it very interesting that the initial conversations around freedom and the network services recommended that not only that the software running the service should be free software, you know, with the running source code available, but also public documents should be under a free content license as well.
Yeah, actually, that what you just said got me thinking, because the way you describe network service project, I've always thought of Wikipedia that way, mm-hmm. as you describe. But as you were just describing again, I started to think, well, basically Identica is that too, because I never really thought of people sending 140 character messages back and forth as creating a work. But of course, it is creating a work under copyright law. It is. But even in a more fundamental sense, beyond just copyright law, it's creating a public record of conversations that people had and what people thought and how they felt, and allowing people to license that in a way that lets them freely redistribute it and add to that conversation and so forth going forward in perpetuity is really important. And while I always saw that as Wikipedia, because it's obvious a very big, important encyclopedia project that's important for the future, in some sense, some of the stuff said on and talked about on something like Identica, while much of it is frivolous, some of it actually is interesting conversation that's important historically.
Yeah, I mean, Identica is a case in point, but I think much more broadly, it's just the way the web works. You link to other users or to other sites. That's really important context for the work you're creating, even if it's just as an individual blogger. And if you can't take that context with you, whether it's to the next generation medium or whatever that is, or when you decide to publish a book or whatever, then the work you're creating is a lot less useful. So
mm-hmm. Yeah, so do you think, this is a question that I ponder a lot about network services issues and autonomous, do you think we're far enough ahead that we will be successful to try and get the message across and create more things like Wikipedia and other types of collaborative projects that are licensed freely? Or are things like Facebook and Twitter, which have so much taken over the mainstream and are sort of the worst examples of this issue and showing how there's problems, are they so ubiquitous now that we've got basically a dark age period again, akin to the dark ages of proprietary software in the 80s, where we're going to have to just work and work and work to get back to just being at the level we were a couple years ago?
Well, it's really hard to make predictions especially about the future, and it's also really hard to draw comparisons to the past. So I basically...
Now you sound like a lawyer.
I would basically say I don't know to that question. I do think that building services that engender the kind of community that you have around Wikipedia is really important for the competitiveness of free culture versus proprietary culture. And I think that it's imperative that people are interested in free culture and really want it to succeed, attempt to build those kind of communities. So I see free network services and some of the surrounding issues that are unresolved, such as what's the right way to govern a community that's collaboratively creating stuff, as imperative for us, I guess coming from the free culture perspective now, to pursue. So it doesn't really matter what I say about whether we're entering a dark age or not. It's just something that we need to do to be successful anyway.
If you were here, you would see us nodding our heads vigorously.
Yeah,
with
because nodding our heads is so good for podcasting. I think a lot about Facebook. I have actually been recently, I learned that my mother is on Facebook, which to me is very weird. When I was growing up, my dad was a programmer and she would say, "Oh, I don't touch those computer things. I don't do anything with them." And she barely could do email in recent years, but she's got on Facebook because that's where the extended family are and that's where pictures are being shared. And the fact that Facebook has become so ubiquitous that it's reaching somebody like my mother who used to be proud of the fact she didn't touch a computer. It's very strange to me to think that this is what computing is becoming to people. And of course, they are getting community out of it. My mother wouldn't have bothered if she wasn't getting some community effect out of it and like the community effect she was getting from it. And I feel a huge sense of challenge to us to try and build the alternative so that it's there and ready when something really goes wrong. Because presumably something's going to go wrong with Facebook and their terms of service. They're going to get more strict. They're going to start doing something that people won't be happy with, hopefully, in some ways, because it'll get people thinking about the issue. But I feel like the clock is ticking on us to get the replacements up and available that are there to go to. And we basically only have it for Twitter because we have Identica. But for the other ones, we don't really have that. They're not there. There's people working on such projects, but they're not far enough along yet to be ready.
Yeah, I'm not so worried about we need to be ready when something goes wrong, because I honestly, Facebook could turn off tomorrow and people would find something else to do with their however many hours a day they spend on the service.
It might actually increase worldwide productivity, or certainly in the industrialized world.
It might indeed.
So, yeah. I don't want us to go too long because we don't want to make our listeners listen to shows that are way long. But is there anything else you wanted to tell us? Anything exciting?
Anything coming up
for Creative Commons?
Well, we are running our annual fundraising campaign right now, and maybe there is a little bit of a free software connection at the moment because Canonical, the company behind Ubuntu, is running a matching campaign. So if you donate right now to Creative Commons' annual campaign, you will get Mark Shuttleworth or his company to match that contribution.
Okay. So
thank you very much for your work. And I also wanted to say that, you know, we really like working with Creative Commons. Diane Peters, who's on our board of directors, is also general counsel, I think, of Creative Commons. So
we have close ties for sure.
We're really grateful that you came onto the show, and we would encourage our listeners to participate.
I just want to put one fire before Mike goes.
Well, hang on. I just want to clearly encourage our listeners to participate in the fundraising drive.
That's what I wanted to say. I wanted to say this is the season where the giving happens, because everybody wants to give before the end of the year to make it tax deductible in the U.S. Creative Commons is a 501c3 charity, so they are also tax deductible, like SFLC and Conservancy and so forth. So pick your favorite organizations and make sure all of these ones I've mentioned and many more are on the list as you decide, and pick some to give to. And I hope people will take advantage of the Creative Commons giving campaign.
Thank you very much for joining us, Mike.
Sure.
Well, that was really interesting. And I'm really looking forward to talking to Mike about some of these issues a little bit more.
I think it's the first time we've had an action item come from a podcast interview.
Oh, yeah.
It's sort of like a conference call where at the end of the conference call you say, what are the action items? Well, we have an action item. You're going to follow up with Mike. And I guess he's going to try to convince you, like he convinced me, that CC by SA is the way to go for things like our podcast.
Yeah, I'm not sure if there's a really good answer for that, because I think that at least the discussions I've had with lawyers, with other lawyers in the past, you know, I think that sort of a necessary, like we have to interpret our ethical rules pretty conservatively. You know, I think to be a careful lawyer means that you have to be extra cautious about this stuff. And I don't know. I mean, I sometimes worry about some of the discussions we have on the podcast and think about, well, whom, you know, I know I regularly say this is not legal advice, but some of the observations I make are kind of off the cuff, and I'm a lawyer, and our listeners know it, and, you know, maybe something I say will be misunderstood. So I think these issues are really tough, and I'm not sure we're going to come to an easy resolution. That said, it's such a small portion of the relevant work out there. I mean, you know, the work of lawyers.
Yeah, well, that makes me glad that I'm not a lawyer. So, and I think I've been convinced to switch pretty much everything that I'm doing to CC BY-SA now. I'm probably going to switch my website and my blog and certainly my talks after that experience at Ontario Linux Fest, where people were basically giving me a hard time about the no derivatives thing. I pretty much decided to go CC BY-SA for all my talks and everything. And I'm going to do what I was saying to Mike, is experiment with seeing if I ever see a problem with it. I think it's unlikely. I think that it's unlikely someone's going to do it. And of course, we should mention that if people do want to make derivative works of our podcast in some way, they can always email us. And that's something people forget, is anytime you see a license that troubles you or you feel is not the right license for the work, you should feel comfortable talking to the copyright holder.
Well, especially if there's something concrete that you want
to
do.
Yeah. And that's what happened to me, right? I think it was fine. I was actually glad people were raising with me. I got asked it like 8 times in the matter of 3 hours, but it was good that people were all asking me, why are you no derivatives? Why don't you do CC BY-SA? And giving out licenses on the cuff is what I started doing, but I was glad that people were raising the issue with me. If they were concerned, they felt that there wasn't the right license and they wanted to use my talk in some way that might create derivative works, I wanted them to. My talk was about switching to GPLv3, and I actually want people to go out there and teach about GPLv3, and if they can use my materials slightly modified to do it, I actually want that to happen. So.
Yeah, and so if you want, I mean, if you do want to contact us to ask us about our show, and you can email us at podcast@softwarefreedom.org. I would like to add that, you know, that the Creative Commons license that I usually use is attribution only for works that are relevant for Creative Commons. So, you know, I am a believer in free licenses, of course, and free culture. So, you know, and whether or not there are tools that we can use to prevent misuse is, you know, is something I care deeply about, but it's not something that's relevant for most of the time for most works. Usually you can freely license something and know that everything's going to be just fine.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think the discussion we're having at the end with Mike about the stuff on Identica and other web interaction is really important. And I think that having that freely licensed is really important. And I'm actually glad that my dents are freely licensed under a Creative Commons license that allow modifications and mix-ups and so forth. It makes for a better internet community communicating with each other.
I think so. I think especially as people start writing, that actually this whole phenomenon of microblogging, like microblog poetry is increasing. And it's, you know, it's tragic to think that people haven't even thought about licensing.
Yeah, I hadn't heard about that specific thing. I guess it's the Twitter haiku or something of fitting a poem.
There are different names for it, yeah.
Or something. Yeah, I don't know. I do like the challenge of fitting something in 140 chars, and I've been actually pretty happy with what I've been able to produce some of the time, and I'm glad that I'm putting it out there. I guess I'm overly proud of my work, but I feel like I've actually been able to say something really concisely. I really like that format because it forces a certain amount of concision. When you just blog out there, I think a lot of people just go on and on and on. But that creativity in that 140 characters, I think, is a creative expression.
Yeah, it's tough, though. It's tough because everybody making these small, you know, everybody microblogging at the same time creates a lot of trivial chatter to wade through to get to something that is valuable.
Yeah, actually, it's actually easier for me. This is a bit off topic, but I found it much easier to have conversations with people on Identica because it doesn't go on and on. And eventually you realize I can't make yet another dent about this.
Right.
And the conversations tend to be relatively short and everybody only says a little bit because they can only say 140
characters.
That's
probably true when there are conversations, but I mean, just like wading through all of that, going to the doctor now. I'm having the chicken for lunch.
Well, I have, you know, I have unsubscribed to people. There are people that I've unsubscribed to only because of the volume. And I think people understand that. Some people want to make that level of volume, and I don't subscribe to people like that, generally speaking. And I have had to unsubscribe to people who do that. So I would say.
And
they're understanding. They know that not everybody wants that. And if they want to use microblogging that way, they know they're only going to get a certain set of subscribers.
Yeah. And I, of course, only pay attention to Identica when anybody actually talks to me.
Yeah, I know. Well, your way of going to the website, I'm on the website as well, but I also have it feeding through XMPP. Mm-hmm. But you like this going to the website. You're not an RSS person. You like to actually go there and be
there. I do a lot of the time. I mean, I think I am slowly shifting, you know, as just to make things more manageable. But I think it's more of just, you know, I just want to be more focused in my day and having, you know. Oh, I guess, I mean, you're the...
I can understand that. That's why I am with
the
email.
The king of that, but yeah.
Not just on email.
Just on... Right, well, I sort of have the opposite. I take my email all the time, but basically everything else I need some distance from.
It's a reasonable... I understand because I have that feeling about email. I think that the 24 hours is absolutely reasonable response time for email, and anybody who expects more than that is expecting too much, in my view.
Yeah.
That's my own. But Donald Knuth agrees with me.
We have the microphone on the art of computer programming, which I know you talked about with Aaron.
Yeah, well, we started that when we moved
to my
office.
But Donald Knuth is ever present in our podcast.
That's kind of true, yeah. His books are anyway. I don't think he's actually here. So he's busy redesigning his kitchen or whatever he's doing. You probably don't know that story. Yeah, he redesigned his kitchen based on an efficiency algorithm by... how hard it was to get stuff and how frequently he had to get he and his wife would get certain things in the kitchen. He did a whole
That's
analysis.
Great.
And it turns out the trash can has to be in the middle. It has to be the trash can is the most used
That's
thing
hilarious.
In his kitchen anyway.
Yeah.
Which kind of makes sense.
It does make sense. It's just most people don't want the trash can in the middle of the kitchen.
But it's the most efficient thing. Why wouldn't you want the most efficient thing?
You're not only maximizing efficiency, you're also maximizing experience.
I mean, aesthetics.
In the kitchen. Aesthetics. In the kitchen. It depends. People use their kitchens very differently.
Okay.
In any event, maybe one day we'll have him on the show to ask him about it.
I don't think
we're going to get Donald.
First of all, we have to send him a letter.
I know.
Because he doesn't take email, which is the whole point that started this conversation. So I think getting Donald, I would love to talk to him specifically about his views on patents because this is the guy, just to actually take this back on topic of another show, this is a guy who has cataloged the most important algorithms of computer science. Of anything the Supreme Court should listen to, which by the way, when people hear this, they will have just had the arguments on Bilski yesterday when they're hearing this. So Donald Knuth's views on that are really important because he understands most completely what a computer algorithm is. He's the guy sitting there spending his entire life's work cataloging all the really important algorithms. Mm. So I would love to talk to him about it. I think I'm never going to get the opportunity.
I think that's probably right.
Which is sad, but he's a busy man and I don't want to bother him.
And luckily we have a lot of really interesting people to talk to.
And I hope he finishes books. It's getting tight as far as given the number of years it's taken him to write books. Mm-hmm. I would love to see him live to 140, but I don't know if humans usually make that. So it's unfortunate, but hopefully he'll get a lot of them done. So I'm looking forward to his next one and his next one and his next one.
Great. So.
And I guess we should.
And I guess we should probably wrap up before it's the longest podcast ever.
No, that would probably be the Bilski one. I think it's going to be hard
That's
to beat.
That's funny.
Yeah, Aaron and I went on and on and on, but people said they liked it. It's good.
Oh, okay.
And I will just mention, you know, take a look. Yesterday, you would have seen because we're recording this ahead of time the Bilski arguments, and they should be available soon in transcript form. So look around for those.
We'll probably add links to our Bilski site at that point.
Yeah. So check it out. And if you need to get briefed on the briefs, go back and listen to two shows ago. And it was well received, I think. And if you haven't heard that one yet, I suggest going back. It's probably one of our greatest hits.
Thanks for joining us. The Software Freedom Law Show is produced by Dan Lynch of HalfBakedMedia.com. Thanks to Mike Tarantino for our theme music. This show is released under the terms of the Creative Commons Attribution No Derivative Works 3.0 United States license.
Forgot to record the little funny thing for the end. Karen? Karen?